He wanted us all out of the way and had the paperwork to back it up, which seemed fair. DCI Hudson said he wanted to talk to the residents and Ron told him to talk to him, Ron, instead. Ron also said that Ian Ventham could stick his paperwork up the proverbial, which is par for the course for Ron, as you know. Donna then suggested that DCI Hudson perhaps should talk to me, as a level head of all things. So DCI Hudson explained the legal niceties to me and warned that he would be forced to arrest anyone who blocked the diggers. I said that I was sure he wouldn't actually arrest anyone, and he agreed that this was true. So there we were, back to square one. Ron then asked DCI Hudson if he was proud of himself, and DCI Hudson replied that he was an overweight, 51-year-old divorcee, and so, by and large, no, he wasn't. This made Donna smile. She likes him. Not like that, but she likes him. I do too. I was going to say to him that he wasn't overweight, but he actually is a bit, and as a nurse, it's best to never sugarcoat things, even when your instinct is to be protective. Instead, I told him he should never eat after 6 p.m. That's the key if you don't want diabetes, and he thanked me. That's when Ibrahim joined us and suggested that DCI Hudson might try Pilates, and Donna said that was something she would pay to see. Ian Ventham didn't want to join in the fun and told Donna and DCI Hudson that he paid their wages. Donna said in that case, could she ask him about a pay rise? And that's when Ian Ventham started shouting the odds about this, that and the other. People without a sense of humour will never forgive you for being funny, but that's an aside. Anyway, Ibrahim, who is very good with this sort of thing, conflict and inadequate men and stalemates and so on, stepped in and offered to thin the crowd out, to give everyone a bit of breathing space. It was agreed that this was the thing to do. Ibrahim walked over to the barricade picnic, which was in full swing, and suggested that anyone who didn't want to be arrested should perhaps move their chairs off the path. This shifted a few of the fair weathers. Colin Clements led the charge. When Ibrahim reassured the rest that they only had to clear the path and were very welcome to stay out and watch the action, there was a proper exodus. Though not a quick exodus, because you know that getting out of a garden chair at our age is a military operation. Once you are in one, you can be in it for the day. Eventually, the scene was as follows. The barricade, with the gate firmly locked behind it, was the stage, and the crowd, happily back in their chairs, was the audience. And who was on stage? There was Maureen Gadd, who plays bridge with Derek Archer, and not just bridge, in my opinion, but that's not to be repeated. Barbara Kelly from Ruskin, who once walked out of Waitrose with a whole salmon and pleaded dementia. My foot, but it worked. And Brona something, who is new and on whom I have no further information. I have seen all three of them on their way to the Catholic Mass on Sundays, then hours later trudging back. They were padlocked to the gate like bikes on railings. And in front of them, the barricade had disappeared and left just one man. Awake now, sitting to attention, unmoved, unbowed, terrific posture. Bernard. Unlike him, I suppose, but he must feel strongly about the graveyard. You should have seen him. The last guard, like Henry Fonda or Martin Luther King or King Midas. This was too much for Ron, who grabbed a chair and sat right next to him. Whether out of solidarity or a desire for attention, who knows? But I was glad that he did. I was very proud of them both, my stubborn boys. I don't mean King Midas, by the way. I mean King Canute. Ventham had gone back to his car for the time being with Donna and Chris. I poured Bernard and Ron cups of tea and settled down myself, assuming the fun was about to end. Which was when the taxi arrived and the fun really began. Forgive me, my doorbell is ringing. I'll be back in a moment. Chapter 50. Father Matthew Mackey always likes to chat to taxi drivers. These days they are often Muslim, even in Kent, and their kinship makes him feel very comfortable. They also react well to the dog collar. But today, he has been silent. He is relieved to see that the gate up to the garden is still locked and guarded and that the diggers are idling on their trailer. He had left a phone number on the notice board outside the chapel for just this eventuality, and that was the number Maureen Gadd had phoned this morning, promising also that she would alert the troops. Mackie took these troops to be the three women in black standing stock still by the gate. In front of them are a woman and two men in chairs who didn't seem quite the type. In fact, now he looks closer, he is sure that one is the gentleman with the opinions from the public meeting. And the man in the middle, is he the man from the bench the other morning? Well, whoever they are and whatever their motive, all are welcome in this particular flock. To the side of the gate is a crowd of around 50 residents, sitting, watching and waiting for a show. Fine. He will give them a show. He supposes this might be his last and only chance. Stepping out of the taxi and giving the driver a large tip, Father Mackey sees Ventham is in a Ford Focus talking to two police officers. One of them is a large man looking too hot in a jacket, the other a young black woman in uniform. No sign of Bogdan, not even in the cab of the trailer. He will be somewhere nearby, surely. Mackey wanders over to the gate. Ventham has yet to spot him. He takes a moment to speak to and bless the three guards. One of them, the mysterious Maureen Gadd, asks if there is the chance of a cup of tea, and Mackey says he will see what he can do. Before heading over to confront Ventham, he stops to introduce himself to the seated figures. Chapter 51, Joyce. Sorry, the ring at the door was a parcel for upstairs and we always sign for each other, so that's where I've been. Sometimes, if I know Joanna is sending me flowers, I pretend not to be in, just so a neighbour picks them up and sees them. Terrible of me, really, but I'm sure people do worse. Anyway, Bernard was saying that he wouldn't take orders from the police. Bernard was staying put, and that was that. Ron said that he'd once been chained to a pit shaft in Glasshoughton for 48 hours and they'd had to defecate into sandwich bags, though he didn't say defecate, and that was when Father Mackey introduced himself. I had seen him at the meeting. He had sat at the back, quiet as you please, and slipped biscuits into his pocket when he thought no one was looking. As I've said, no one ever realises I'm watching. I just have one of those faces. I have to say he was very polite and he thanked us for protecting the garden. Bernard told him the garden was only the start of it, and once you give someone an inch, then we all know what they'd take. Ron then had to have his say and told Father Mackey that his lot, the Catholics, had not always been squeaky clean when it came to graveyards, but that a liberty was still a liberty and he didn't like to see one being taken. Father Mackey said that wouldn't happen on my watch, and it all got a bit cowboy film, which was fine by me. I like to see men being men, up to a point. This is when Ventham must have caught sight of Father Mackey, because over he rushes, with Chris, Donna and Ibrahim chasing behind. And so, the stage was now set. Chapter 52. Bogdan has been digging for a long time. Why not? Might as well be getting something done. He started at the very top of the Garden of Eternal Rest, where the earliest graves are now permanently under the shadow of the wide branches of the trees behind the wall. The ground is softer, with no sunlight in many years, and Bogdan knows that the older, grander coffins here will be intact. They will be solid oak. They won't be split or rotten. There will be no skulls staring up at him, hollow and eaten and hopeful. He hears the odd bit of excitement from down the hill, but still no rumble of the low loader, so he keeps digging. One of the machines could uncover a whole row of graves in minutes, especially if not much care is taken, which Bogdan knows will be the case. So he chooses to be neat and tidy, for as long as it is just him and his shovel. The next grave he chooses to tackle is tucked tightly in the top corner of the graveyard. As he digs, he is thinking about Marina, the woman he met on his way up here. He has seen her before in the village, but mainly people don't talk to him, they don't even notice him, and that's okay. He doesn't suppose you are allowed to visit people here, but maybe one day, if he bumped into her again, then that would be okay. He misses his mother some days. Bogdan's shovel finally strikes something solid, but it is not the lid of the coffin. There are many stones and tree roots which make the job harder but more fun for Bogdan. He reaches down and clears thick earth off the obstruction. It is pure white. Beautiful, in fact, thinks Bogdan in the moment before he realizes what it is. This was not part of Bogdan's plan. The very point of digging here was that there would be no rotten coffins and no bones. And yet here they were. So even 150 years ago, they were cutting corners? Cheap coffins? Who would ever find out? Should he just fill the grave back in, pretend it never happened and wait for the diggers? Something about that makes him feel uncomfortable. Bogdan has uncovered a bone, and that makes him the guardian. He has no smaller tool than the shovel with him, so kneels down on the compacted earth and starts to work with his hands alone. He is as gentle as he can be. He shifts his kneeling weight to get a better angle to clear away more dirt, and as he does so, he realizes he is not kneeling on compacted dirt, but on something much more solid. He realizes that he is kneeling on the solid oak lid of the solid oak coffin. Which can't be. A body can't escape from a coffin. Bogdan tries to force out a horrific thought. Had someone been buried alive? Had they managed to somehow clamber out of the coffin, but no further? Bogdan works quickly with no room for ceremony or superstition. There are many bones and then a skull, though he tries not to disturb it. He uncovers enough of the coffin to jam the blade of his shovel under the lid. After considerable effort, he breaks open the lower third. Inside is another skeleton. Two skeletons, one inside the coffin and one outside. One small, one big, one grey and yellow, one cloud white. What to do? Somebody should take a look at it, that was fairly certain. Though that would take a long time. They would dig with tiny trowels, Bogdan had seen it on TV, and they wouldn't just be digging into this grave, they would be digging into all of them. And Bogdan knows it will end up being nothing. It will just be how they used to bury people in this country, or one year there was a disease and they buried people together, or a million other possibilities. Meanwhile, the development will be delayed and he will be waiting to work. So the question remains, what to do? Bogdan needs thinking time, but unfortunately he doesn't have that luxury. In the distance, Bogdan hears a siren. He waits a moment and the siren comes closer. It sounds like an ambulance to Bogdan, but he knows logically that it must be the police. Which means the barricade will be clear soon enough and the circus will begin. Bogdan hauls himself out of the grave and starts to fill it in once more. Ian will tell me what to do, he thinks, as the sirens reach the bottom of the path. Chapter 53. Ian Ventham, exiting the police car, is calm, happy even. The police have had a placatory chat with him. He'll come back tomorrow. The graves aren't going anywhere. Perhaps sending in the diggers so early was a mistake, but it was a cool thing to do, so a mistake worth making. It was a statement, and making statements is important, whatever they are. He doesn't mind the residents being up in arms. They'll soon lose interest. He can just give them something else to complain about. Sack one of the waiting staff that they like, or ban grandkids from the pool on health and safety grounds. Then they'll be all, what graveyard? He has to laugh, really, and so he does. But at that very moment, he sees Father Matthew Mackey, standing there in his frock and little white collar like he owns the place, as bold as you like. This is Ian's land, for Christ's sake. It's Ian's property. He storms towards the barricade and has his finger in Father Mackey's face in seconds. If you weren't a vicar, I would knock you out. The crowd starts to surround them like a fight in a pub car park. Get off my property or I'll get you thrown off. Ian aims a shove at Mackey's shoulder, knocking the older man backwards. Mackey reaches out for balance, grabbing Ian's t-shirt, and the two men lose their balance and fall to the ground together. Donna, with the help of a horrified-looking Karen Playfair, pulls Ian up and off the priest. A group of residents, including Joyce, Ron and Bernard, then surround and restrain Ian Ventham while a group of residents on the other side form a guard around Father Mackey, now sitting dazed on the ground. School playground, really, but he looks shaken. Calm it, Mr. Ventham, calm down, yells Donna. Arrest him! Trespass! Yells Ian, now being pulled away from the scene by a group of determined septuagenarians, octogenarians, and even one nonagenarian who had missed Second World War call-up by a day and has regretted it ever since. Joyce finds herself in the scrum. How strong these men must have been in their time, Ron, Bernard, John, Ibrahim. And how diminished they were now. The spirit was still willing, at least, but only Chris Hudson was really able to hold Ventham back. The testosterone was lovely while it lasted, though. I'm protecting sacred ground, peacefully and lawfully, says Father Mackey. Donna helps Father Mackey to his feet, dusting him down and feeling the frailty of the old man beneath his loose black cassock. Chris pulls Ian Ventham from the scrum of bodies surrounding him. He can see the adrenaline surging through Ventham's body, the sort of thing he's seen a thousand times before in the late-night drunks of too many towns. The veins riding the muscles that poke out from his t-shirt, a giveaway of steroid abuse. Home now, Mr. Ventham, orders Chris Hudson, before I arrest you. I didn't touch him, protests Ian Ventham. Chris remains quiet to keep the conversation private. He stumbled, Mr. Ventham, I saw that, but he stumbled after you made contact with him, however light. So if I want to arrest you, I will. And allow a policeman a hunch. There might be one or two witnesses to help me in court. So if you don't want to be charged with assaulting a priest, which wouldn't look good in your brochures, then you get in your car and you drive away. Understand? Ian Ventham nods, but without conviction, his brain already somewhere else making some other calculation. He then shakes his head slowly and sadly at Chris Hudson. Something's not right here. Something's up. Well, whatever's up will still be up tomorrow, says Chris. So you get yourself home, calm yourself down, and mop your brow. Be a man and take a defeat. Ian turns and walks towards his car. Defeat? As if. As he passes the low loader, he bangs twice on the cab door and cocks his thumb towards the exit. He walks slowly, thinking. Where's Bogdan? Bogdan is a good guy. He's Polish. He needs to get Bogdan to tile his swimming pool. He's too lazy, they all are. He'll talk to Tony Curran. Tony will know what to do. But did Tony lose his phone? Something about Tony. Ian reaches the Range Rover. The car has been clamped. His dad will be furious. He's only borrowed it. He'll have to get the bus from town and his dad will be waiting for him. Ian is frightened and starts to cry. Don't cry, Ian. He'll see. Ian doesn't want to go home. He searches his pockets for change, then stumbles and topples backwards. He reaches out for something to hold on to, but to his surprise, there is only air. Ian Ventham is dead before he hits the ground. Part 2. Everyone here has a story to tell. Chapter 54. Joyce. I tripped over a loose paving slab in Fairhaven a few weeks ago. I didn't mention it in my diary because of murders and trips to London and my pursuit of Bernard. But it was a nasty tumble and I dropped my bag and my things went everywhere. Keys, glasses, case, pills, phone. Now, here's the thing. Every single person who saw me fall came over to help. Every single one of them. A cyclist helped me to my feet, a traffic warden picked up my things and dusted down my bag. A lady with a pushchair sat with me at a pavement table until I'd got my breath back. The woman who ran the cafe came out with a cup of tea and offered to drive me around to her GP. Perhaps they only came to help because I look old. I look frail and helpless, but I don't think so. I think I would have helped if I saw a fit youngster take the tumble I did. I think you would too. I think I would have sat with him. I think the traffic warden would have picked up his laptop and I think the woman in the cafe would have still offered to drive him to her GP. That's who we are as human beings, for the most part. We are kind. However, I still remember a consultant I once worked with at Brighton General up on the hill. A very rude, very cruel, very unhappy man, and he made our lives a misery. He would shout and would blame us for mistakes he made. Now, if that consultant had dropped dead in front of my eyes, I would have danced a jig. You mustn't speak ill of the dead, I know, but there are exceptions to every rule, and Ian Ventham was one of the same type as this consultant. Come to think of it, he was called Ian too, so that's something to look out for. You know those people, people who feel the world is theirs alone. They say you see it more and more these days, this selfishness, but some people were always awful. Not many, that's what I'm saying, but always a few. All of which is to say that in one way, I'm sorry that Ian Ventham is dead, but there is another way to look at it. On any given day, lots of people die. I don't know the statistics, but it must be thousands. So, somebody was going to die yesterday, and I'm just saying that I would rather it was Ian Ventham who died in front of me than, say, the cyclist or the traffic warden or the mum with the pushchair or the woman who ran the cafe. I would rather it was Ian Ventham, the paramedics failed to save, than that it was Joanna or Elizabeth. Or Ron, or Ibrahim, or Bernard. Without wanting to sound selfish about it, I would rather it was Ian Ventham who was zipped into a bag and wheeled into a coroner's van than me. For Ian Ventham, though, yesterday was the day. We will all have one, and yesterday was his. Elizabeth says he was killed. And if Elizabeth says he was killed, then I expect he was. I don't suppose he expected that when he woke up yesterday morning. I hope I don't sound callous. It's just that I have seen a lot of people die, and I have shed so many tears. But I have shed none for Ian Ventham, and I just wanted you to know why. It is sad that he is dead, but it hasn't made me sad. And now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go and help solve his murder. Chapter 55. Well, here's the big headline. Chris Hudson is standing at the front of the briefing room, his team spread out in front of him. Ian Ventham was murdered. Donna de Freitas looks round at the murder squad. There are a few new faces. She simply cannot believe her luck. Two murders, and here she is, right in the middle of it all. She had to hand it to Elizabeth. She definitely owed her a drink, or whatever else Elizabeth might prefer. A scarf. Who knew what Elizabeth would like? A gun, probably. Chris opens a folder. Ian Ventham's death was caused by fentanyl poisoning. A massive overdose delivered into the muscle of his upper arm. Almost certainly in the moments leading up to his collapse. You'll tell by the speed that this is not official. This is me calling in a favour, okay? And they see enough fentanyl overdoses at the Path Lab these days to know one when they see one. We're the only people who have that piece of information at present, so let's keep it that way as long as we can, please. No press, no friends and family. He gives Donna the briefest of looks. Chapter 56. So we were all witnesses to a murder, says Elizabeth, which, needless to say, is wonderful. 15 winding miles away, the Thursday Murder Club is in extraordinary session. Elizabeth is laying out a series of full-colour photos of the corpse of Ian Ventham alongside every conceivable angle of the scene. She had taken them on her phone while pretending she was calling for an ambulance. She then had them privately printed by a chemist in Robertsbridge who owed her a favour due to her keeping quiet about a criminal conviction from the 1970s that she had managed to uncover. Tragic, too, in its way, if we wanted to be traditional about our emotions, adds Ibrahim. Yes, if we wanted to be melodramatic, Ibrahim, says Elizabeth. First question, then, says Ron. How do you know it was a murder? Looked like a heart attack to me. And you're a doctor, Ron? Asks Elizabeth. As much as you are, Liz, says Ron. Elizabeth opens a folder and takes out a sheet of paper. Well, Ron, I've already been over this with Ibrahim because I had a job for him, but listen carefully. The cause of death was an overdose of fentanyl administered very shortly before death. This information is straight from a man who has access to the email correspondence of the Kent Police Forensic Service, but it hasn't yet been confirmed by Donna, even though I have texted her repeatedly. Happy, Ron? Ron nods. Yeah, I'll give you that. What's fentanyl? That's a new one on me.
It's an opioid, Ron, like heroin, says Joyce. They use it in anaesthesia, pain relief, all sorts of things. Very effective. Patients rave about it.
Also, you can mix it with cocaine, says Ibrahim, if you were a drug addict, say. And the Russian security services use it for all sorts of things, says Elizabeth. Ron nods, satisfied. Ibrahim says, and as it must have been administered very shortly before his death, then we are all suspects in his murder.
Joyce claps her hands.
Splendid. I'm not sure how any of us would have got hold of fentanyl, but splendid. She is arranging Viennese whirls on a plate commemorating Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson's wedding, something Joanna had assumed she would like many years ago.
Ron is nodding, looking at the photos of the scene, looking at the faces of the residents craning for a better view of Ian Ventham's slumped body.
So, someone at Cooper's Chase killed him. Someone in these pictures.
We are all in the pictures, says Ibrahim.
Except for Elizabeth, of course, says Joyce, because she was taking the photos. But she would still be a suspect for any half-decent investigation.
I would hope so, agrees Elizabeth.
Ibrahim walks over to a flip chart. Elizabeth asked me to make a few calculations. Elizabeth, Joyce and Ron settle into the jigsaw room chairs. Ron takes a Viennese whirl to the relief of Joyce, who now feels able to do the same. They are own brand, but there had been a Greg Wallace program which had said they were made in the same factory as the proper ones. Ibrahim begins. Somebody in that crowd administered an injection to Ian Ventham which killed him, almost certainly within a minute. There was a puncture wound found on his upper arm. I asked you all to compile a list of everybody you remembered seeing, which you kindly did, although not all of your lists were alphabetized in the way I had asked.
Ibrahim looks at Ron. Ron shrugs.
Honestly, I get mixed up somewhere around F, H and G and then I give up.
Ibrahim continues. If we combine these lists, an easy job if you know your way around an Excel spreadsheet, then in total there were 64 residents at the scene, ourselves included. Then we added D.C.I. Hudson and P.C. De Freitas, the builder Bogdan, who went missing.
He was up on the hill, says Elizabeth.
Thank you, Elizabeth, says Ibrahim. We add the driver of the low loader, whose name was Marie, another Pole, if that is of interest. She also teaches yoga, but that's by the by. Karen Playfair, the lady who lives at the top of the hill, was there as she was supposed to teach us about computers yesterday, and then, of course, Father Matthew Mackey.
That makes 70, Ibrahim, says Ron, now onto his second biscuit, whatever diabetes might say.
And Ian Ventham makes 71, explains Ibrahim.
So, you think he might have driven up, started a ruck, then killed himself?
All right, Poirot, says Ron.
This isn't thinking, Ron, says Ibrahim. This is just a list. So no impatience, please.
Impatience is all I got, says Ron. It's my superpower. You know, Arthur Scargill once told me to be patient.
Arthur Scargill.
So, one of these 70 people killed Ian Ventham. Now, these are nicer odds than the Thursday Murder Club usually faces, but can we narrow down the field still further? It would have to be someone with access to needles and drugs, suggests Joyce.
But that's everyone here, Joyce, says Elizabeth.
Quite so, Elizabeth, agrees Ibrahim. If I might be permitted a visual image, that would be like looking for a needle in a haystack made entirely of needles. Ibrahim pauses under the assumption there might be applause at this point. In its absence, he continues. Now, the injection would be the work of a split second to anyone experienced in intramuscular injections, which, again, is all of us. But the drug would need to be administered at very close quarters. So I have deleted the names of anyone we know for a fact was never in close proximity to Ian Ventham. That loses a lot of the supporting cast. The fact that many of the crowd suffer from severe mobility issues has played into our hands here, as we know they couldn't have managed a quick dash when none of us were looking.
No Zimmers, agrees Ron.
We lose 8 names on Zimmer frames alone, agrees Ibrahim. Mobility scooters are also our friends here, as are cataracts. There are also many people, such as Stephen, I hope you agree, Elizabeth, who never found themselves close to Ian Ventham on that morning. They are struck from the list. Also, 3 residents were padlocked to the gate until someone thought to call the fire brigade sometime later in the day. And so, here we find ourselves. Ibrahim turns over the top sheet of the flip chart to reveal a list of names. 30 names, ourselves included, and one of them is the killer. I pause only to take note that, alphabetically, by surname, I am first on the list.
Well done, Ibrahim, says Joyce.
So that's the list, says Elizabeth, and I'm guessing it's now time for the thinking. Yes, I think between us we can trim down the list a little further, says Ibrahim. Who wanted him dead? Says Ron. Who gained? Did the same person kill Curran and Ventham?
Funny to think, isn't it? Says Joyce, wiping crumbs from the front of her blouse. That we know a murderer, I mean, we don't know who it is, but we know we definitely know one.
It's brilliant, agrees Ron.
He is considering Biscuit 3, but knows there's no way he would get away with it. Well, we had better get started, says Ibrahim. Conversational French are due in at 12.
Chapter 57.
Which means, says Chris Hudson, that the fentanyl must have been administered by someone who was there that morning. So, one way or another, we already know our killer. Today, we work on a full list of everyone who was there, which won't be easy, but the sooner we have it, the sooner we'll have the killer. And who knows, maybe Tony Curran's killer too. Unless Ventham killed Curran, and this was retaliation. Donna chances a quick peek out of the briefing room window. Her uniformed colleague, Mark, is putting on a bicycle helmet, perfectly complementing his morose expression. Donna sips her tea, murder squad tea, and thinks about suspects. She thinks about Father Mackey. What do they really know about him? Then she thinks about the Thursday murder club. They were all there, all surrounding Ventham at one point or another. She could imagine them each in their own particular way being a murderer. Hypothetically, anyway. But actually, she couldn't see it.
They would certainly have a view, though. Donna should probably head over and see them.
In the meantime, continues Chris, opening another folder, I have some other fun jobs for you. Ian Ventham was not a popular man. His business dealings were complicated and wide-reaching, and his phone has revealed a list of affairs, which must have been pretty tiring for him. Tell your loved ones they won't be seeing much of you for a while.
Loved ones? Donna thinks about her ex, Carl, then realizes she hasn't thought about Carl for a good 48 hours, which is a new record. Though she has thought about him now, which spoils it a little. She realizes, though, that soon she won't think about him for 96 hours, and then a week, and before you know it, Carl would just seem like a character from a book she once read. Really? Why had she left London? What happens when these murders are solved and she's back in uniform? And the rest of you, no let-up on the Tony Curran case. The two could be connected. We can't rule it out. We still need the speed camera info. I particularly want to know if Ian Ventham's car was on that road that afternoon. I need to know where Bobby Tanner is, and I need to know who took that photograph. And I still need the information on the phone number that called Curran. Which reminds Donna of a little hunch she has been meaning to check.
Chapter 58. Elizabeth is back in Willows, sitting in her low chair in Penny's room. She is filling Penny in on the drama.
Simply everyone was there, Penny. You would have been in your element, swinging your truncheon and arresting everyone in sight, no doubt.
Elizabeth looks over at John in the chair, where he spends most of his waking hours.
I'm guessing you filled Penny in on the details, John.
John nods.
I may have overstated my own bravery a little, but other than that, it was chapter and verse.
Elizabeth, satisfied, pulls a notepad and ballpoint pen from her handbag. She taps a page of the notepad with her pen, like a conductor giving notice to her orchestra, and begins.
So, where are we, Penny? Tony Curran is bludgeoned to death by person or persons unknown. As a side note, I will never tire of saying bludgeoned.
I bet you used to say that a lot in the police, you lucky thing.
Now, Ian Ventham, meanwhile, dies within seconds of being injected with a huge dose of fentanyl. You know fentanyl, John?
Of course, says John.
Used it all the time, anaesthetic mainly.
John the vet. Elizabeth remembers the fox that John nursed back to health with Ron. Once healthy, it had gone on to murder Elaine McCausland's chickens. Not proven, but there were no other suspects. Ron had taken a lot of grief for it at the time, which had pleased him enormously.
How easy would it be to get hold of it? Asks Elizabeth.
For someone here, John starts, well, not easy, but not impossible. Pharmacists would have it.
You could break in here, I suppose, but you'd have to be very determined or very lucky.
And you can get it on the internet.
Goodness, says Elizabeth, can you?
The dark web. I read about it in The Lancet. You can get all sorts. A rocket launcher, if you really wanted one. Elizabeth nods.
And how would one go about getting on the dark web?
John shrugs.
Well, I'm guessing, but if it were me, the first thing I would do would be to buy a computer. Perhaps go from there?
Says Elizabeth.
Might be worth checking who has a computer.
You never know, agrees John. It would certainly narrow it down. Elizabeth turns back to Penny. How unfair to see her lying there.
One man bludgeoned Penny, the other poisoned, but by whom?
If Ventham was killed straight away, then somebody out there this morning killed him.
Me or John?
Or Ron or Ibrahim?
Or who knows? Ibrahim has a list of 30 names on a spreadsheet to start us off.
Elizabeth looks at her friend again. She wants to walk out of the door with her right now, arm in arm, share a bottle of white, listen to her swear like a docker about some imagined slight, and sway home happy and tipsy. But that will never happen again.
I always find it peculiar that Ibrahim doesn't come and visit you, Penny.
Oh, he does, says John.
Ibrahim visits, says Elizabeth. He's never said.
Like clockwork, Elizabeth, every day he brings a magazine and solves bridge puzzles with her.
He talks them through. They solve the puzzle, he kisses her hand, and off he pops half an hour later.
And Ron, asks Elizabeth, does he visit?
Never, says John.
I suppose it's not for everyone, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth nods. She supposes so too.
Back to business. So, Penny, who wants to kill Ian Ventham? And why, at the very moment, digging was about to start? I suspect your question might be, who loses what if the development goes ahead? Wouldn't you think? I want to talk to you about Bernard Cottle at some point. Do you remember him? With the Daily Express and the nice wife. I feel like there is a motive there, waiting to be winkled out.
Elizabeth stands ready to leave.
Who loses what, Penny? That's the question, isn't it?
Chapter 59. Chris Hudson has his own office, a little bolt hole where he can pretend to work. There is a space on his desk where a family photograph might ordinarily sit, and he feels a prick of shame every time he notes its absence. Perhaps he should have a photo of his niece. How old was she now? 12? Or maybe 14? His brother would know. So, who killed Ventham? Chris was right there when it happened. One way or another, he actually watched him being killed. Who had he seen? The Thursday Murder Club, they were all there. The priest. The attractive woman in the jumper and trainers. Now, who was she? Was she single? Now's not the time, Chris. Concentrate. Had the same person murdered Ventham and Tony Curran? It made sense. Solve one. Solve the other? Who were the three calls to Tony Curran's phone from? Almost certainly someone trying to sell him life insurance, but you never knew. Chris is sure that Tony Curran's phone could tell all sorts of tales. Human rights are all well and good, but Chris would love to tap the phone of every single person in Fairhaven who looked even a bit suspicious. Like they do in prison. He remembers an armed robber called Bernie Scullion, who ran out of money in Parkhurst but wanted to buy himself a PlayStation, so phoned his uncle and told him where he'd buried £500,000. The police had the money and the uncle within the hour, and Bernie never got his PlayStation. There is a knock at the door, and Chris has the brief, disturbing realization that he hopes it's Donna.
Come.
The door opens. It's D.I. Terry Hallett. Terrifyingly efficient, handsome in that Royal Marine way that everyone seemed to like, but also, annoyingly, a nice guy. Chris would never be able to wear a T-shirt that tight. One day, Terry will have this office. Terry has 4 kids and a happy marriage. Imagine the photographs he will have on the desk. Chris wishes he was Terry. But who really knew what went on at home? Perhaps Terry had a hidden sadness. Perhaps he cried himself to sleep. Chris doubts it, but at least it's something to cling to.
I can come back, says Terry, and Chris realizes he has been staring at him for a beat too long.
No, sorry, Terry, miles away.
Thinking about Ian Ventham?
Yep, lies Chris.
What have you got?
Sorry,
to drag you back to Tony Curran, but I've got something I think you're going to like, says Terry. I've got a car that took 12 minutes to travel the half mile between the two speed cameras either side of Tony Curran's house. Exactly the right time frame, too. Chris looks at the details. So it stopped somewhere between the two? Nice little 10-minute break for something or other? Terry Hallett nods. Anything else around there except Tony Curran's house? Somewhere you'd stop? There's a lay-by, if you needed a slash, but... Long slash, agrees Chris. We've all had them, but even so. And you've run the number plate? Terry nods, then smiles. I like that smile, Terry. What have you got? You won't believe the registered owner, Gov. Terry slides another piece of paper onto Chris's desk. Chris takes it in. Well, this is very good news. You sure about these timings? Terry Hallett nods and drums his fingers on Chris's desk. That's our killer, surely. Chris has to agree. Time to go and have a chat. Chapter 60. Bogdan has seen where Marina lives and now is as good a time as any. She will know what to do about the bones. He sensed that as soon as he met her. He has brought her flowers. Not from the shop, but from the wood. Tied the way his mother used to tie them. Flat 8. He presses the buzzer and a man's voice answers. This surprises Bogdan. He has kept a close eye on her for a while and not seen a man. The external door to the flats swings open. I am here for Marina to see Marina, he says as he walks through. The first door of the carpeted hallway swings open and he sees an elderly man in pyjamas running a comb through his thick grey hair. Maybe he has got this wrong. Either way, the man will know Marina and can point him in the right direction. I come looking for Marina, says Bogdan. I think maybe she live here, but maybe another flat. Marina? Of course, come in, let's get the kettle on, shall we? Never too early, is it? Says Stephen. With an arm round his shoulder, the man ushers Bogdan in. Bogdan is relieved to see a picture of Marina, a younger Marina, on the hallway table. It's the right flat. I don't know where she is, old chap, but she won't be long, says Stephen. Probably at the shops or round at her mother's. Sit yourself down and let's make the most of the peace and quiet, eh? You play chess at all? Chapter 61. Chris Hudson is pulling his coat over his jacket as he leaves the station. He turns as a voice behind him calls out. Sir? It is Donna de Freitas. She catches up with him. Wherever you're going, I think I've got a change of plan for you, says Donna. I doubt it, PC de Freitas, says Chris. He still calls her PC de Freitas at work. I'm off to have a little chat with someone. Only I was looking through the call logs, says Donna, and I recognise the number. The mobile that called Tony Curran? Donna nods, then takes out a scrap of paper for Chris to see. Remember this, Jason Ritchie's number. He's the one who phoned Tony 3 times on the morning of the murder. Is this worth the change of plan? Chris holds up a finger to silence her and takes the piece of paper Terry Hallett had handed him from his jacket pocket. He passes it to Donna. Vehicle records from the day of the murder. Donna reads and then looks up at Chris. Jason Ritchie's car. Chris nods. Jason rings Tony Curran that morning. Jason's car is outside Tony's house when he dies. So, we're going to see Jason? Maybe just me this time, says Chris. I don't think so, says Donna. Firstly, I'm your shadow, which is a sacred bond of trust, etc., etc. And secondly, I just solved the crime. She waves Jason's phone number at him. Chris waves the vehicle records at her. I solved it first, Donna. So I'm just going to pay him a quick visit at home, alone, and see if he wouldn't mind answering a couple of questions. Very low key. Donna nods. Good idea. He's not at home, though. I checked already. Then where is he? If you take me along, I'll show you, says Donna. And what if I ordered you to tell me where he was? Asks Chris. Well, you can try, says Donna. See where it gets you. Chris shakes his head. Come on, then. You can drive. Chapter 62. Neither Chris nor Donna had known that Maidstone had an ice rink. Why on earth did Maidstone have an ice rink? That had been a large part of the conversation on the drive there. This was after Donna had asked Chris to turn off his compilation of early Oasis B-sides. Bit by bit, Donna was intent on dragging Chris from his century into hers. The mystery had not been solved when they pulled up outside Ice Spectacular. How was anyone making money out of an ice rink, just off a ring road, sandwiched between a tile warehouse and a carpet rite? Chris would often tell friends that if there was a business in their neighbourhood that didn't make any sense, which had no customers, then it was a front for a drugs business. Always. No real customers needed, no real profit needed, just a way of washing money. Every town had one tucked away somewhere, on a little row of shops or in the railway arches, or sat next to a carpet rite. Whether it was a waxing parlour or a party lights hire shop or an ice rink with a neon sign that last lit up in 2011. Always a front, always drugs, thought Chris as he closed the passenger door of his Focus. Which seemed apt, given who Chris and Donna were here to see. They walked through the front doors, across the sticky carpeted foyer and into the arena. At this time of day, it is mostly empty except for an elderly man hoovering up popcorn from rows of plastic seats and two figures out on the ice. Anyone who had seen Jason Ritchie in his prime would tell you the same. He had a fluid strength, his feet simply gliding around the ring. Those powerful arms arcing through the air or flicking forwards in rib-rattling jabs. His tiny feints and dips, eyes never leaving his opponent. His whole body ready to pounce and strike. He wasn't a slugger, a big plank of wood, a zombie. He was an athlete. Strong and brave, a magnificent flowing machine, everything given, nothing wasted. With his grace and his poise and his movement, Jason Ritchie was beautiful to watch. However, as Chris and Donna sip on coffees watching, it becomes apparent that Jason Ritchie cannot ice dance. The session seems to be over and Jason is gingerly skating towards the side of the rink, his elbow being supported by a small woman in a purple leotard. Even so, about a metre from the sweet safety of the side, Jason's left skate disappears from underneath him, slices into his right skate, and his tumbling weight is too much for the lady in the leotard to save. The big man is down again. Chris and Donna have been watching for only a matter of minutes, but have already lost count of his falls. Chris leans over the board and offers a hand. It is the first time Jason clocks the two officers. He has been preoccupied. He looks Chris in the eye as he takes the proffered hand and finally reaches dry land. Have you got 5 minutes, Jason? Asks Chris. We've come ever such a long way. Are you okay, Jason? Asks the lady in the leotard. Jason nods and gestures for her to go on ahead. Yeah, a couple of mates. I'm going to stop for a chat. Well, look, I'm going to write this all up and send it to the producers, says the skater. You're not a lost cause, I promise. Darling, you're a superstar. Thanks for putting up with me and picking me up off my arse. Hopefully see you on the show, says the skater and waves as she disappears up the steep stairs on her narrow blades. Jason collapses onto a moulded plastic chair which bends a little under his weight. He starts to unlace his skates. Thought I might see the two of you again. You got another photo for me? Well, shall we dive straight in? Starts Chris. What were you doing at Tony Curran's house on the day he was murdered? None of your business, says Jason. He nearly has the first skate off, though it's a struggle. But you agree you were there? Asked Donna. Am I under arrest? Asked Jason. Not yet, says Donna. Then it's none of your business if I was or wasn't. The first skate is finally off. Jason puffs like he's just gone three rounds. Just so you have the full picture, says Chris, pulling out his phone from his pocket and swiping it into life. We'd been trying to find Ian Ventham's car on the traffic cameras near Tony Curran's house. A nice open and shut case. Ian Ventham didn't visit Tony Curran that afternoon, but we found something even more interesting. The first traffic camera catches your car, Jason, about 400 yards east of Tony's house at 3:26, and then the next camera, the other side of Tony's house, catches you at 3:38. So, either you took 12 minutes to drive half a mile, or you stopped somewhere in between. Jason looks at Chris very calmly, then shrugs and starts on his right skate. Okay, I've got one too, says Donna. The day that Tony Curran was murdered, did you ring him? Don't remember, I'm afraid. Jason is picking at what seems to be an impossible knot in his laces. You'd remember that though, Jason, wouldn't you? Asked Donna. Ringing Tony Curran? One of the old gang, wasn't he? Never been in a gang, says Jason, finally making a breakthrough with the knot. Chris nods. But here's our issue, Jason. A mystery number phones Tony Curran three times on the morning of his death, a number we couldn't trace thanks to Vodafone and to data protection legislation, but a number that, thankfully, you had personally written down and handed to PC De Freitas. So, your number, Jason. Jason finally has the second skate off. He nods. That was silly of me. And then, that very afternoon, you are driving along the road outside Tony Curran's house, at which point you stop to perform some sort of errand which takes around 10 minutes, at the exact time that Tony Curran was murdered. Chris looks at Jason for a response. Yep, sounds like you've got yourself a mystery there, says Jason. Now I've got these skates off, I'm going to head back. Jason stands. Chris and Donna do too. I wonder if you'd like to come in and give us some fingerprints and a bit of DNA, says Chris, just to eliminate you from our inquiries. We could eliminate you from two murders at once. That would be nice. You should probably ask yourself why you don't have my prints and DNA already, says Jason. Maybe because I've never been arrested for anything. Never been caught, Jason, says Chris. That's different. Be interesting to hear a motive too, says Jason. Robbery? Says Chris. Man like that has a lot of money lying around. You got any money worries at the moment? I think time's up here, don't you? Says Jason, starting to climb the stairs to the changing room. Chris and Donna don't follow. Or are you doing celebrity ice dance for the prestige, Jason? Asked Donna. To which Jason turns and gives a genuine smile, then raises his middle finger, turns again, and continues towards the dressing room. Chris and Donna see him disappear, then sit back down on their plastic chairs and look out over the empty ice. "What do you make of that?" asks Chris. "If he did it, why on earth would he leave a photo with him in it by the body?" asks Donna. Chris shakes his head. "Perhaps some people are just stupid?" "He doesn't seem stupid," says Donna. "Agreed," agrees Chris. Chapter 63. From outside, Elizabeth can immediately see that something is wrong. The curtains in Stephen's study are open. They are always closed. Stephen doesn't like the glare of the morning sun when he writes. Her brain makes all of the necessary calculations in a second. Has Stephen woken and broken his routine? Is he hurt, lying on the floor, alive, dead? Or has someone broken in? Someone from her past life? It does happen even now. She has heard of it happening. Or perhaps someone from the messy present has paid her a visit. Elizabeth circles to the fire door at the back of Larkin Court. It is impossible to open from the outside without a piece of kit available only to the fire service. Elizabeth opens it and slides inside. Her feet make no sound on the carpeted hallway, but they would have made no sound on the concrete walkway of an East German detention centre. She takes out her keys and coats the Yale in lip balm. It makes no noise when she inserts it in the lock, and Elizabeth opens the door as quietly as she can, which is very quietly. If there is someone in the flat, Elizabeth knows her time may be up. Holding her keyring in the palm of her hand, she slides a different key through each of the gaps in her fist. Stephen has not collapsed in the hallway. That is news, at least. His study door is open, morning sun streaming in. She feels a momentary shame at the bright dust dancing in the doorway. "Checkmate," says a voice from the living room, an Eastern European voice. "Well, I'm damned," replies Stephen. Elizabeth slips her keys back into her bag and opens the living room door. Stephen and Bogdan sit across the chessboard from each other. They both smile to see her. "Elizabeth, look who it is," says Stephen, gesturing to Bogdan. Bogdan has a moment of confusion. "Elizabeth?" "He calls me that. He gets things wrong." To Stephen, "It's Marina, dear. Remember? This doesn't feel wonderful, but needs must." "Like the man said," agrees Stephen. Bogdan has risen from his chair and extends his hand towards Elizabeth. "I brought you flowers. Your husband has put them somewhere, I'm not sure where." Stephen is examining the end game on the chessboard. "The bugger got me, Elizabeth. Fair and square." Elizabeth looks at her husband, crouched over the board, backtracking moves, clearly delighted with the trap in which he has been caught. Life in the old dog yet, then, thinks Elizabeth, and falls in love again for the thousandth time. She repeats, "It's Marina, darling."
"I call you Elizabeth, is okay," says Bogdan.
"He fixed the light in my study too, dear," says Stephen. "We have a marvel on our hands." "That's very kind of you, Bogdan. I'm sorry we're not as clean as we might be. We don't get guests, so sometimes." Bogdan places his hand on Elizabeth's upper arm.
"You have a beautiful home, Elizabeth, and a wonderful husband. I wonder if I can speak to you."
"Of course, Bogdan," says Elizabeth.
"I can trust you?" asks Bogdan, staring deep into Elizabeth's eyes.
"You can trust me,"
says Elizabeth, her eyes never leaving his. Bogdan nods. He believes her.
Can we go for a walk, you and I, this evening?
This evening? Asks Elizabeth.
I have something to show you. It's best to wait till dark.
Elizabeth studies Bogdan. Something to show me? Any clues?
Yes, it is something you will be interested to see, says Bogdan.
Well, I'll be the judge of that, says Elizabeth. And where will we be walking, Bogdan?
To the cemetery, says Bogdan.
The cemetery? A slight shiver runs down Elizabeth's spine. How wonderful the world can be at times.
I meet you here, says Bogdan, and wear warm clothes. We be there for a while.
I think you can count me in, says Elizabeth. Chapter 64. Joyce.
Yes, I know Ian Ventham is dead, and we will get to that, I promise. But guess what else? Joanna is here.
We took ourselves down to Fairhaven in her new car. I will check the make in a moment. We stopped at Anything with a Pulse. I was very casual about it, but it was an unqualified success. Not a word of complaint or no one's a vegan anymore, Mum, or they do better brownies in a Lebanese shop round the corner from mine, Mum. Green tea, flapjack, macaroon. And I didn't think I'd be saying that. She has a meeting down this way, something to do with optimization. If I think back to that girl who would eat her fish fingers and potato waffles, but scream blue murder about eating her peas, I didn't imagine she would ever be having meetings about optimization, whatever it is. The boyfriend is history, as we'd guessed. Did you know you can lock your mobile phones these days so that no one can take a peek? And you can unlock them with your thumbprint. Anyway, he had fallen asleep on the sofa one evening and she had used his thumb to open his phone. One look through his messages and by the time he woke up, his suitcases were packed and in the hall. That's my girl. No details of the messages were forthcoming, but Joanna strongly hinted that photographs were involved. I listened to enough Woman's Hour to get the gist of that. Excuse my language, but the silly sod. We had a giggle about it, so I don't think her heart is broken. I can hear Joanna getting up from a nap, so I'll say bye for now. You wouldn't know it, but I've been typing quietly. My gorgeous baby. Happy and sleeping in my bed and two murders to solve. Who could ask for more? Joanna brought a bottle of wine down with her. There is something special about it, but I'm afraid I've forgotten what it is. One day she will realise that she is the something special. Anyway, I invited Elizabeth over to have a drink with us this evening, but she has other plans. Your guess is as good as mine there. Something to do with the murder, though, you can bet on that. Additional note added later, it is an Audi A4. Chapter 65. The path up the hill towards the Garden of Eternal Rest is a pale ribbon in the dusk light. Bogdan offers his arm and Elizabeth takes it.
Stephen is not well, says Bogdan.
No, dear, he's not well.
You put something in his coffee, I think, when we left.
We're all on pills for something, dear. Bogdan nods. He understands. They walk past the bench where Bernard Cottle spends most of his days. Elizabeth has been thinking some more about Bernard, has had to in the circumstances,
She always gets the sensation that he is keeping guard for the cemetery. That he somehow